Hello and welcome to the podcast for episode 212. I'm Ronald D. Moore, executive producer and developer of the Outlander television series, and here to welcome you just by my lonesome self all this time. This episode is interesting in that it maintained its basic shape and narrative form and much of the script throughout its entire development process. Most of the changes that happened in this episode were pretty scene-specific or production-specific. The biggest changes that occurred were really at the conceptual stage when we were sort of laying out season two and, you know, where the various events would take place. Readers of the book know that the events in this episode have been reshuffled from the sequential order in the book. That was for a variety of reasons, mostly because of the way the season was laying out and the way we, you know, how many hours of TV we had to tell this story and where you kind of want the high points and low points to be, where the war steps in, you know, when you play the war story, when you don't, when you bring in other characters, and building towards a climax, you know, towards the end. Just an aside, the main title card here is kind of cool. I like the map with the little figures being moved around on the battlefield. It kind of reminds me of a little show called Battlestar Galactica, some of you may remember fondly, where we did similar sort of beats and shots with Vipers and Raptors being moved around the plotting table in Galactica's CIC. But anyway, the events in this episode, like I said, have been sort of resequenced from the book. The way the book lays out, once Claire and Jamie are back in Scotland and the Jacobite rebellion is underway, they kind of go out on the road rather quickly. They don't go directly to the Fox's lair, you know, Jamie's grandfather's house, Simon Lovett, or Lord Lovett, you know, or as early as we did. They fight a battle. They then return to Edinburgh. After the victory at Prestonpans, they go back to Edinburgh, and the city of Edinburgh welcomes them. There's some balls and celebrations. Charlie is feted around the city. There's some interesting stuff that takes place at a ball there. And it was at that scene where Colm McKenzie came back into the story. Sought out Claire to help, to, you know, looking for ways of easing his final days and also sort of wanting to talk about, you know, the future of Clan Mackenzie and how it would play out in the Jacobite Rebellion. And then Colm died and the leadership of the Clan Mackenzie passed to Dougal, who then threw the Mackenzies into the war full force. Then they went out on the road once more. Then the Duke of Sandringham events happened. Then they came back into Scotland. Also in that first Edinburgh visit, they also encountered Alex Randall and Jack Randall, got that story going. And then on the second trip back to Edinburgh later is when Mary was then married to Alex. And then from there, it went on to Culloden Moor. When we were laying out the structure of the season and I was looking at all the cards up on the board, I sort of felt that for television and for the purposes of how the season lays out and plays dramatically, that it didn't feel like the beats were in the right place. I felt like once they got the news to go to war and we become a war story, it didn't feel right to sort of stop that mid-tale and sort of then take a side journey, what felt like a side journey to Lord Lovett's house and into Edinburgh and zigzag a little bit in terms of the war effort. It sort of felt like step one felt more logical to me to say, all right, you get the word that that you're going to have to fight this war whether you like it or not, and step one should be go get some men. So let's move up the Lord Lovett story so that the first step that Jamie has to do is go get men with Claire. So that gets it going. Then let's do training, getting the men ready for war. So that became episode 9. Then let's do a real war story. Let's do a battle. Okay, now that's 10. Okay, now that you've done one big battle, now you felt like you could bring in other elements. Now let's get to that Duke of Sandringham story. Do that here. Now you're in a place, now you're at episode 11. Now you've only got two episodes left in the season. It didn't feel right to then go to Edinburgh and do the big balls and do the big celebration, because it also felt just out of whack with the rhythm and flow of what we had to do. If you're going to do that big Edinburgh story, if you're going to do the tale of them going to the city and doing the balls and the receptions and all that, and play that for all it's worth, that's a big production expense. It takes a lot of time, takes a lot of money. That's going to have to be a full episode just by its nature. You couldn't do it for just a scene. You know, if you're going to go to the trouble of building the hall or finding that location and filling it with extras and costuming them and all that, that's a pretty big deal. So you're going to basically commit to doing a whole episode in Edinburgh for that story. And I didn't want to do that in the middle of the season. It felt like we'd already done, or in the middle of the war story. We'd already done, you know, Versailles. We'd already done a lot of sort of big, splashy types of events in the Paris part of the story this season. And for time and for money, I didn't feel like those were resources I wanted to spend on that story. I thought, well, what's the important stuff that happens there? The column showing up into the story again and dying is the biggest thing that happens in the Edinburgh section of the book. So bringing that character back again a second time this year, it was cool, and I definitely want to do it, and definitely want to play the final beats with Colm, but let's put it closer to the end. Let's make it in the penultimate episode, so that things are coming to conclusions together, so that the narrative story arc is sort of, you know, the narrative story arc and the character story arcs are kind of in tune a little bit more. So the Colm's death is right on the eve of the Battle of Culloden, and taking it. There was also a feeling that, well, if we go to Edinburgh to do that story, now we've got to play a city that's a much bigger expense. It's much more difficult. Let's not go into the city. Let's play it in a smaller town. Let's go to Inverness, which is actually closer to Culloden. And so let's say that we start talking about, all right, so we're in the war's final stages. Things are not going well for the Jacobites. Let's say that they are now, for a moment, they find themselves camped outside of Inverness. The army's outside the city, close to Culloden Moor, and Claire from there can go on the errand that you're seeing here now on screen, where she goes into town to try to find to replenish her stocks of medicinal supplies, and that's where she encounters Mary Hawkins. Mary, you know, again, there's a big time cut in between these two episodes, so Mary, you know, after the episode with the Duke of Sandringham, went off on her own, found Alex Randall once more, and, you know, got together with him, and Claire hasn't seen her in the meantime. This is a location you'll see again in this episode as well as the next episode. This is Tuke, and we play a lot of sort of the Highlander encampment outside Culloden here at Tuke. Tuke is spelled T-O-U-C-H. Those of us who are Americans tend to call it touch, and then they're corrected until we finally get in our heads that it's actually pronounced Tuke. This is an actual location at Tuke. This is inside that house that you just saw a moment ago. This is, you know, there's a lot of these scenes in this story, but they're sort of necessary to tell us what's going on and to lay out the hows and whys of the rebellion and why it ultimately fails and, you know, where it all went wrong and what the arguments were and how did the army, you know, find itself fighting on this very bad terrain in a very bad situation on that fateful day. The whiskey today is Scapa 18. This used to be hard to find in the States. It used to be my so-called house scotch for many, many years on my own. And I think the distillery almost went out of business or something, but now they're revitalized. And so I'm happy to find Scapa on my local liquor shelves once again. These aren't sequences that were in the book. The book, once again, was told, this section of the book was told first-person narrative. So Claire was not in these scenes with Jamie in the book. So a lot of this is our invention, but it felt sort of important to understand sort of what was going on in the High Councils. And we had, you know, set up pretty early in the season Jamie's involvement with Prince Charlie and his role as one of the prince's confidants, so he could speak up in this kind of a setting. And then this would allow us to get an insight to how these decisions are made and watch as, you know, as they all go sideways.
I am not some frightened her to be run down by a pack of British hounds. I am a man, and I am a soldier, and I shall comport myself as one. I'm weary of retreat.
Again, I love the way Andrew plays Prince Charlie. You know, this mixture of heroism, or at least nascent heroism, reaching for heroism, but not having really the wherewithal to carry it off. And he's really not the man that he wants to be, but you can see how desperately he wants to be that man. A fair amount of that out there is real, the Highlander camp, and a fair amount of it is digital wizardry. You know, you tend to bring in as many practical tents and so on as you can, and then digitally sort of duplicate them. We call it tiling, which I've probably talked about before. When you multiply, you tile out, you know, how many actual pieces and how many actual extras you have. Claire is now on our sound stages in Cumbernauld. This set was built. This is one of the few scenes I actually saw them shoot. I was there for the rehearsal of this. I wandered down to the stage and tried to stay out of the way. Watched them rehearse this scene in Jack's entrance here. We did play around quite a bit with how Jack and Claire met. In the book, she's in Edinburgh, and I believe he comes to the door and just surprises her, and she goes outside to go have a one-on-one conversation with him, and so that Jamie doesn't, you know, see that he's there. And it takes place in the streets of Edinburgh, and Jack comes directly to Claire to plead for his brother, to say that he's really in a bad place and needs help, and if she will come help him, Jack is willing to give intelligence, military intelligence, on the British Army that could help the Jacobites, and that's the trade that he's willing to make. And Claire agrees to those terms and goes to help Alex. We kind of wanted to go a different route on that. Felt like let's start with Mary, that we run into Mary first, and then so that Claire is kind of drawn in by her guilt over what she did to Mary and Alex back in Paris and trying to split them up. And then so she's already on a more sympathetic foot. When she walks into the room, she's there to treat Alex to begin with, and then she's taken unawares when Jack suddenly comes back into the story.
When do you think you'll be able to go back to work again? Mary, I think you need to start making reparations with your family. So you have somewhere to go when Alex...
Alex what?
You won't be going back to work. He can't be cured. I'm sorry.
Can't be cured.
But he must be cured.
Not quite. I mean, a lot of discussion about this. I'm never... not quite convinced that that's the right beat of Mary just putting her hands over her stomach and Claire sort of realizing that she's pregnant. It's a subtle thing. I get that it can happen, but I guess on some level I don't quite believe it. On some level I wish she had just said, "I'm pregnant," and blurted it out. But it was just one of those things that you kind of go back and forth on in scripts, so whether something will read visually or not. A lot of discussion about, you know, who Jack is now. You know, what does Jack want? Again, like when we ran into him in Versailles, or in Paris, either one, Versailles or Paris, he's a man who's gotten what he wanted. You know, he wanted to break Jamie, and he did that. So what does he want now? Well, now what does he want is to save his brother's life. There was something really interesting about discovering Jack's genuine affection for his brother, which we had touched on in back at Versailles, when he says that's why he was there in the first place, to try to get secure his brother a job. But the depth of his feeling for his brother, his genuine fraternal feelings for Alex, are really the central emotional core to this episode. And I thought that was a really interesting and great thing to do. I really liked that aspect of the character in the book, which was that, you know, he's horrific. He does horrific things, you know. And like I've said before, I never wanted Jack to be simply a monster that you could dismiss, that he was a man, that he had a man's passions and he had a man's vulnerabilities. And, you know, he had gone down a dark and twisted path and embraced the darkness from which he wanted no release. However, he was still a human being. And this sort of beat of him pleading for his brother's life and then sort of calling Claire on the fact that she's now the one being manipulative and she's now the one bargaining with a man's life, I thought was a really interesting turn. And I really like, again, I like the fact that that's how Diana set up the character, that Jack was a complicated villain. He was a very complicated player in the drama. And I like the opportunity to go see him another time here this season and really play that aspect of the character out, you know, to sort of force yourself to look at Jack and realize that here's a guy who did all this shit to Jamie, who's been their pursuer and has been their nightmare and has never been, you know, they've never been able to shake him loose, but he loves his brother. He genuinely, honestly, truly loves and cares about his brother, probably to the exclusion of anyone else in the world. His, you know, Alex is probably the only person in Jack World's universe that he actually cares about and is actually moved by his predicament. And I just think that's a fascinating aspect of the character, especially since we like Alex too, and clearly so does Claire. Love seeing Rupert in the eye patch anytime we get to see that. This whole little welcome of Colm, they were all supposed to go out to the carriage and help him down and meet him out there. It was all scripted to be outside, but it was pouring down rain. It was like one of those epically like wet, horrible, freezing cold nights. So they made a last minute change. They said, look, we got to play this inside. He's got to come in and we just got to play this whole scene inside because there's just no way we're going to shoot this out. It's just like muddy and terrible and it's rainy even by Scottish standards. So this whole scene got moved in at the last minute. So great to see Gary again. Some familiar faces. Yeah, great to see some familiar faces is right. I like that he knows about Angus's death and that he cares about Angus's death. You know, it says something. You know, he's the Laird, and Rupert and Angus were so far down, you know, on the totem pole from where he was, and I'm sure he barely ever acknowledged them, you know, before that. But the fact that, you know, he would take a moment to sort of, you know, mark the passing of one of their band. I like that about the character. Now again, as I said before, the scene that's coming up with Jamie Dougal and Colm did not take place in the book, and in fact, it happened differently. You know, Dougal got command, and we just decided to go a different route because it felt like Colm, in the way we've played the story, Colm knows where this is going. He's more adamantly opposed to the rebellion than he was in the book. You know, we had played the whole episode of Lord Lovett's where he had come specifically to try to avert the disaster that he saw, you know, on the horizon. So it felt like that Colm McKenzie, once you play that episode, that Colm McKenzie, it doesn't seem like he would just hand the reins over to his brother, knowing full well that then Dougal is going to take the clan and take it literally over the cliff. He had already expressed an interest in having Jamie be the clan chieftain upon his death. That was established a couple times in season one, and it felt like Colm now, you know, reaching the end and having to make these kinds of hard choices, would still rather hand the clan over to Jaime than to his brother, because he just can see what's happening. You know, the Jacobite army is falling apart, that the war is not going well. It started out well, they had a lot of victories, but, you know, now the tide has turned, they're in desperate straits, the war is not over, but Colm can see the future pretty clearly, and it just seemed to us like the crafty move for him would be to turn to Jaime and try to get Jaime to take Clan MacKenzie. Jaime might well take them into battle. He might well lead them into the war. But, like I said, he wouldn't take them over the cliff. And I think that line is even in the script, because that's the line we kept using in the writer's room over and over again, was, yeah, but Jaime won't take them over the cliff, and Dougal will take them over the cliff. And ultimately, that's, you know, what Dougal's... That's what Colm is most concerned about. Now, this scene is based on the book scene. It's not a literal interpretation of the book scene, because again, so much has changed and we are in such a different context. But there was a last Colm Clare scene in the book, and you know, the request for to make his death an easier one, and all that is definitely something that was drawn from and inspired from the book. It's just a great opportunity to sort of play last scenes between these characters. You know, Colm, you know, is one of those indelible characters, I think, in the series, because he's one of the first people you meet at Castle Leek. She and Clare has what I think is a great first scene with him in his rooms at Castle Leek. You know, when he's trying to figure out who and what she is, and she's, you know, having to come up with excuses and things on the spot, and he doesn't quite believe her, but he can't quite punch holes in her story, and she turns the tables on him at one point. And they've had an interesting relationship, and I was really happy that we could do a final beat between these two characters. And, you know, I think Gary Lewis has really, you know, embraced that character and made it his own, and he's been a very important part of the show. See, when I'm doing these podcasts by myself, then you have to suffer through some of these bouts of just silence as I wonder what to say next. Because there's no one here to bounce questions off of. This was shot, you know, in a block with the last episode, episode 213, which is a 90-minute episode. So this was a fairly large block, you know, almost like the super block that we started off the season with, where we shot episodes 1, 2, and 3 together. This wasn't quite as massive as that, but it was a pretty big undertaking, because you're juggling a lot of different storylines, and in two completely different time periods once again, you know, like at the beginning. There's a two time period section in 213 coming up, and then you've got all this 18th century stuff in 212. There are some shared locations and sets.
I've never heard him mention it.
Excuse me. I mean, part of my job, you know, as sort of showrunner and looking at the series overall, often is to sort of step back and look at, you know, the overall view. You know, a lot, you hear me talk a lot in these podcasts about rhythm, about tonality, about where we are in the season, deciding sort of what the flow of things will be. I think this is a good example of that, is this episode, in terms of, all right, What is this? What do we want this episode to accomplish? You know, in terms of the mood and the rhythm of the season, knowing that you're about to get to the finale. The finale, by definition, has to have a certain oomph and climax to it. It doesn't have to necessarily have the most spectacle in it. It doesn't necessarily have to have the most action in it. But it is the season finale. It is the thing that's going to have to hold the audience for a long, longish period of time. I know some of you, the Droughtlander thing is sad, and I feel for you on the Droughtlander front. But it is what it is. So you are constructing the finale with an idea towards, okay, it's a big meal because it has to hold them for a long time. So then you sort of step back from there and you look at the episodes leading up to the finale and what should they be like. You don't want the episode before the finale to in any way echo it or to be repetitive of what's going to happen in the finale. So it's by definition, it should not be a big, you know, a big war story or something, because clearly the war element is going to take over a big chunk of the finale itself. You don't want to repeat the character beats between Claire and Jamie. You don't want any kind of repetition in the penultimate episode. And yet the penultimate episode sometimes has as you're constructing a television series, the penultimate episode sometimes runs the danger of being nothing but table setting, that really nothing is accomplished in it, nothing really happens. You can just kind of feel the writers, you know, setting things up, setting the table for what's about to happen next. And a lot of times that episode becomes very unsatisfying as a result, because the audience has an intuitive sense of what you're doing. And the audience kind of knows that, okay, this is all kind of bullshit, and they're just teasing this out because nothing's really going to happen in this episode, because next week is where it's all really going to go down. We fought hard against that temptation. And we were aided in great part by the fact that we have this book and we had moved certain elements around. We still had this story that was supposed to take place earlier, and now we're going to put it here. So now we've got this sort of interesting show where we have sort of this double brother thing going on, which we hadn't really thought about at the outset. But then as the show came together, we started realizing that this show is defined by these two stories of two sets of brothers, Jack and Alex, and Dougal and Colin. And those are really the emotional pillars around which the show revolves. And that each of them will have a resolution. Each of them will have a death. Each of them will have a mourning brother. Each of them will involve our characters. One will involve mostly Claire. One will involve mostly Jamie. It's interesting and to me unusual that you constructed that episode around two supporting characters, Jack and Dougal are the supporting characters who suffer the primary losses. Each of them is losing their literal brother. Claire and Jamie are a little more removed from that drama, and neither one is losing a sibling, neither one is losing someone who's, you know, special in that way to them. Even though they're fond of those people, it's still not their principal loss. So the emotional story is really being told a couple of rings out from the center. But for us, that really kind of works. Like, if you told me that was the intention going into a story like this, my first reaction would be, well, how does that become about our characters? Why isn't it about, you know, our regulars, about our central cast? But I guess my reaction now is twofold. One is that in our series in Outlander, the story itself lends itself towards becoming about a lot of different things. The plot moves in many different directions. The threads take you in unexpected places. And these supporting characters become very, very important. And Dougal and Jack are kind of members of the family, if you think about it. I mean, Colm is definitely a member of the family. And Alex is a character that we're fond about. And so this sort of dual death of the two brothers does kind of work for us. It's like, it does feel like it's part of the show. It doesn't feel like it's a side journey into something else, at least not to me. And I guess my second reaction is that I enjoy the fact that this series has started to embrace more and more of the supporting characters and giving them full stories and really sort of embraces them as part of the family, because that was one of the great things about that other show I did, Battlestar, to bring that up once again, in that there were many supporting characters that started out with very small parts and that then became core members of the family as the series went on. And I enjoy that. I enjoy watching characters grow and develop and move to center stage, and they start off as one thing and then they turn into something else. Witness Rupert. Rupert is now really a bigger member of the family than he certainly was when we first met him. And Angus's death, meant something that you probably wouldn't have thought it would have meant, early in the first season. But again, to go back into the scene specifically of what's on screen right now, the relationship between Alex and Jack, I just thought was a fascinating one. I like the idea that Alex knew some of his brother's issues, and that in that speech right there, he acknowledges that Jack, struggles against the darkness, or at least he thinks Jack struggles against the darkness. Jack embraces the darkness, as we know, but on some inner level, Jack may have problems with that. But he's kind of embraced and doesn't want to be released. And Alex, the optimist, looks at his brother and with his brotherly love and thinks that Jack, can't escape it yet still. This is an actual trick. This was that thing of blowing that particular kind of smoke into a patient's lungs to help them was an actual palliative. This is again Tuke. This is a great location. We were there for. You'll be seeing this location again in episode 213 quite a bit. As I talked about before, there's a mixture of digital and real tents and extras and horses and whatnot in the background. It's kind of a testament to the state of the art that you can now do background shots like that that are out of focus and in the distance, and that you literally can't tell what's real and what's not. The state of CGI and digital post is really just amazing. It's come way, way up. It's moved incredibly fast and become much, much cheaper than it used to be. Richard Briscoe, our visual effects producer, is excellent at this kind of material and pulling it off. And Richard and I had just a couple of conversations about philosophically not wanting to know that they were visual effects and always wanting to feel like it was location or practical, and Richard is very much in tune with that idea of mine as well. This was another location I was actually there for, which was an amazing thing to me. Now I look at it, I'm like, wow, I was actually there for this. This is shot in Falkland, which is the village which was our Inverness. It's supposed to be Inverness in the story. And it was also our Inverness location in episode 101 in the pilot. This is the same village where Claire and Frank, went to Mrs. Baird's and drove up and walked through the streets and all that. That this street where we're filming this Murtaugh Claire scene is literally like two blocks away from the street where Mrs. Baird's inn was, in that little town circle with the well in the center. So this is, we're playing it as Inverness in the past and in the 20th century, and it really was Inverness in the past and the 20th century for us. And it was great to be back in this little village. I think when we originally scouted it back with John Dahl, who directed the pilot in the second episode, and Gary Steele and I, we walked around that village for a while, and I remember thinking, us discussing at the time, that we could use Falkland over and over again, because there were streets like this, there was the town center, there were little pubs, there was a small park, there were other alleyways. It kind of felt like we could keep going back to here multiple times, like maybe that could be the place where the Garrison Commander episode was going to be filmed, or maybe there would be taverns there to shoot. Ultimately, for a variety of reasons, we ended up not using it as nearly as much as we thought we would, but it was great to get back to Falkland, especially for me, to go back there after all that time and walk down those streets again and sort of bring it all back. And ironically, to have Jack and Claire there, where it was one of those physical locations where we'd had Frank and Claire there as well. Uh, As I recall, there's nothing really inside that particular structure. Or maybe there is. Now I'm questioning that. Maybe this is actually inside there, because I didn't see the interior of the tavern being shot. So it may well be inside there. I went out to the location that day, watched them shoot the walk and talk between Murtaugh and Claire, and then I had to go do other business, as they say. So I'm not entirely sure where the tavern is. I want to say it's on the sound stages, but I'm not positive. It feels like the sound stage to me, but there is a chance that this is actually on the location. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. This is a great scene. You know, this is not a scene from the book, but this is an extension of the Jack Randall character and his relationship with Claire, and you know, trying to get to the place where Claire can support this idea that she's going to marry Mary, that he's going to marry Mary. I like the idea that Claire actually has to argue for this thing to happen to this man who she loathes, you know, that she actually has to sort of tell him to do the thing that it's so counterintuitive to believe that she wants to have happen, that she actually wants Mary Hawkins to marry this guy. Because she kind of has the knowledge that he's not going to make it very long. Great, it's such great chemistry between these two actors. I mean, and they play the scenes so differently when it's, you know, when he's Jack and when he's Frank, obviously, but they just have an intuitive sense of where the other was going. You can see, if you're on the set and you're ever, you know, of course you won't be, but if you're ever on the set and you're privileged enough to watch the two of them work together, it is an interesting exercise in sort of shorthand between actors. You know, one does something, the other picks it up, hands it back. You know, you watch them sort of work in real time, and it's really a delight and a pleasure whenever we would have these two together. When you have Sam and Katrina together, when you're playing Claire and Jamie, it's a similar kind of thing. You're watching them work together, and they have a shorthand and a different kind of and a communication between the two, and they have this real intimate intuitive sense of where they're going, and it's great to watch that rhythm play out as well. It's just, you know, we're really blessed on the show with a tremendous cast. You know, the cast, they're all dedicated professionals, they all believe in the material, they believe in each other, they support each other. You know, it's a tremendous ensemble, and whenever you're around them and you see them working together, they just all step up their games as soon as action is called, and they just really bring it. It's really great. It does remind me of, I'll say it a third time, Battlestar Galactica, where you just watch the cast grow and evolve and, you know, depend on each other and hand things one to the other. Nobody was too concerned about whether they had the best line or the best moment in a scene. Everyone was just committed to making the scene work. Here's another example. These three actors, putting them, the three of them in this room, watching them work together, it's just fantastic. It's an amazing thing. You see Sam knows where he is in the game. He's got his head together. Graham and Gary are playing off of their familial relationship. Sam is thinking on a couple of different levels as he goes through the scene, you know, what his attitude should be, how he's balancing his attitude between the two warring brothers. You know, and all three of them are willing to share the space, and all three of them are willing to give to each other and wait for the other's beat. No one's chewing scenery, and nobody's trying to, like, steal the limelight. It's just great. It's a tremendous tremendous gift that we have in our cast. know, look at Sam just kind of takes himself out of the scene for a second. Just walk. He literally like walks away, hands the stage over to Gary and Graham. It felt to us, I mean, we definitely wanted to include Dougal in Column's end. You know, it didn't really play this way in the book, but it just felt like we had told a story of these two brothers from the very beginning. From episode two, we had started to tell a story about the two brothers, and now that one brother was going to die, it just felt, it demanded in our minds that you bring the two brothers together again before the end, that you had another big fight, another final, you know, bit of conflict between the two of them that went to the heart and went to the root of what their conflict has always been, which was about who's number one, who's the chieftain, you know, how does Column's illness affect their relationship, and how does it affect the clan Mackenzie.
Deny me the boy's guardianship, when by rights you should be proposing me a successor.
Jamie is our sister's son. He shares our blood, and you know it. Besides,
yeah, and this is sort of been the topic of conversation among the Mackenzies, among the higher ups of the Mackenzies for a long time, and even among the clan itself. You know, we had played in season one the fact that people were already looking towards Jamie as a potential successor. It wasn't sort of a secret that Jamie could be the one to take over upon Column's death. It just felt like it hadn't really been said openly very often.
Has that thought ever crossed your mind?
Christ's bloody cross. I love Hamish, and he is considerably fond of me. He barely even knows Jamie.
He's your spawn. He's your very fond of reminding me. And again, that deep affection you hold.
Something great too about the sort of ad hoc setting that they're in, that, you know, we're not back at Castle Leac, we're not in some, you know, great place in Edinburgh, we're just at this house along the road of the army, and that the army is being swept along to its own destiny and the destiny of Scotland. But there's this moment where, you know, the dying man and his brother and their nephew have this final confrontation in this room that's just kind of thrown together, and they found a fire, and, you know, there's still crap sitting around, and, you know, that it's not very regal, and it's not really a big setting to sort of, you know, discuss the rise and fall of clans and, you know, lairdships and kingships and so on, but it just takes place here in this time, in this setting, in this sort of, you know, thrown together environment, while just outside the door, you know, the lives of the fate of a nation is quickly being decided. I really like the sort of tone of the scene, and that it's very intimate, and it's just these three men in the world, even though, again, just outside those doors, you know, huge events are grinding towards their conclusion. I mean, we're shooting this, again, this is being shot in the last block of filming for season two, so everyone is aware that time is running out, so you're sort of dealing with two different pressures. One is the exhaustion factor on the cast and the crew. It's a long season, it's a difficult season. You know, you've had to deal with Paris, you've had to deal with the 20th century, we've gone to Prague, we've been traveling around, we're building sets, it's winter, it's cold, it's freezing. You know, the physical wear and tear and the fatigue is setting in, and people are just want to get to the end. You're just getting really, really tired. And yet, the other pressure is there's so much story to tell, and each of these days you're starting to feel is not long enough, and you're feeling like you don't have enough days in the production. I didn't feel like we were running out of money, thankfully, this time. It wasn't a case of, oh my God, the treasury is nearly empty and I have to spend, we're not going to be able to afford stuff. It was really time. It was, you're just running out of time. And adding days to the production, yeah, it's expensive, but the bigger problem is you're not going to make your air dates. You've reached the point in your season where you don't have a lot of flexibility in terms of post-production. You know, the time to edit, to score, to do sound editing, color correction, visual effects, and all the various components that go into completing a show and delivering a show. You just don't have a lot of time. You know, you had a lot more time at the beginning. Now, here doing the final two episodes, time has run out. You have very little margin of error. And so you can't just sort of arbitrarily say, hey, well, we're just going to shoot for another week. So you've got to, like, finish the show. So you're fighting those two things. One is the exhaustion of everybody involved from top to bottom, and the second is the tremendous amount of material there is and the frantic need to fit it all in as quickly as possible. So these are tense days. These are tiring days. You know, you can say that mud there is real. There's a lot of mud out there on this location. It rained torrentially on and off, and sometimes you caught it on camera and sometimes you didn't. But the physical location out there at Tuke was very challenging. So you're dealing with that, and you're also doing pickups and reshoots. And while we're shooting this last block, we're also going back doing pickup shots from previous episodes, things that were missing, things that had to be redone, insert shots that hadn't been done or maybe were done incorrectly. All the little main title cards that we have every week, a lot of them were getting slotted in. You know, Matt Roberts, who's one of our writer-producers and does Second Unit for us, was doing overtime this section of filming, helping to pick up various shots that were needed for a variety of things, just some complete second unit shots with stunt work and that kind of thing, and other little tiny shots of just like picking up a piece of paper. So here is your into the last block, you become really aware that time is running out and that every day is precious, and oh my God, we have to make the day, we got to make the day. So a lot of times you're out there on the set, and the writer, producer, the creative producers, we call them, is making really hard decisions in terms of, okay, if we don't make this day, we're in trouble. So I may have to cut a scene. I may have to cut some lines out of a scene. I may have to make some editing choices quickly here because I can't afford for the production to get over. I can't afford for us to go to multiple days. We have to complete it because otherwise we're not going to make the air date. And that takes over. So it really, even as it's sort of, everyone's exhaustion and needs a little time and is bleary-eyed and getting a little punchy at this point, but everyone has to really bear down and work even harder and pay even more attention, more detail work, more focus on things because you don't have any margin for error. We knew that we would come back a couple of weeks after the final wrap of this block and do some more pickup shots. We did build in some time to come back and do a couple of more things afterward because, you put the episodes together and you realize, oh, we need this shot here or that shot didn't work, we have to redo it. So you had to build that in, but that was a very narrow window and there was no room for error on that either. So again, as we're going through all these scenes, just sort of be aware that as this episode and the final episode are being shot, that the entire production is under a tremendous amount of strain as you're getting to the end. This is a bravura performance by Grant McTavish. I mean, this is like a great piece. It's a great piece of writing by Anne and Ira, who wrote this episode. And it's just a great performance by Graham. It's basically kind of a big monologue, with Gary in the bed. And Graham just knows how to do this kind of thing. And he just really he's able to hold the camera and hold the scene. Gary is able to sort of give him the space. And yet Gary's, Colm is really, a commanding presence, even from the bed, even with, barely moving and barely being alive at this point. He's still sort of centering a lot of the emotional action of the scene. Great job in editing this scene. I think the world of our editors overall in post-production who do just bang up work week after week after week, and there's a subtlety to the editing and, you know, and a sensitivity to it. It's not bouncing around the room. It's not quickly cutting from angle to angle to angle for no reason. It's, you know, you're not afraid to be in shadow a lot. You're just letting, you know, what I like about our editing team is they let the story, you know, dictate the cut. They follow the story. They're paying attention to where the emotional beats are in the story. You know, when you're going to Dougal, how long you're going to stay with Dougal, when you go back to Colm, how often do you remind the audience that Colm is even in the room? And hopefully you get to this point where you're with Dougal and you're pulled in by what he's saying and by the performance and by the words, and you kind of forget about Colm, you know, and just like Dougal is forgetting about Colm until it's too late, and that at the moment when he looks back over and realizes that he's lost his brother, the audience realizes it too, that, you know, the audience is really in his head, and it takes a lot of elements to make that work. You know, you have to have the performance, you have to have the shot, and you have to have the editing hand to stick with it, to keep it there. You don't want to like bounce around here. You notice that we're sticking pretty much with one long take of Graham as he's doing this, and you have nowhere else to look. You just have to look at him. You're just going to stick with him, and his performance is pulling you inside of him, and so you're there with him. It's great. See, it's just, you don't want to cut to Colm there. If you had cut to Colm when he was there, then it kind of breaks the mood. It breaks the moment. It breaks sort of your intimacy with the character of Dougal in this moment. And you want to just be totally drawn into him until it includes him. Notice we didn't cut to him. We just included him. Now, that's a good choice on the part of the director, Philip John, who included him in the shot. As Graham leaned forward, shot widened and panned slightly to the left and included Colm. As opposed, it's a nicer choice, because the easy way is to just cut from Dougal's face and do a clean cut to Colm sitting there. But that kind of jolts you on some very subtle level. And just by following Dougal left in that camera left in that shot and including Colm, it's I don't know, there's something about it, it's just a subtler, more interesting way of embracing, you know, the second character in the room rather than the abrupt cut. I love the fact that Dougal, he had his chance. He could have said the things he wanted to say to Colm, and he blew it. He waited too long. He got a little too indulgent with himself and his feelings, and then it's too late. And that's sort of the final, you know, verdict on his relationship with his brother. It was all too late. And he never did the thing he always wanted to do. He never wanted to tell him how he really felt. He never wanted to really be... He never got to really do that. And then the end of Alex. I'm pretty sure that this reaction of Jack is something that think this is something Tobias came up with, that his reaction would be to pound on his brother as this sort of expression of rage and anger at himself, at his brother. It's a way of sort of almost declaring, I'm still a horrible person, look at me now, I'm beating my dead brother, aren't I a horrific monster? And then on some level, that's easier for Jack to sort of, you know, deal with as a self-image than the vulnerability, than the sadness, than crying, than sort of expressing any kind of like human emotion, identifiable human emotion, empathetic human emotion, than if he reacts out of anger like that, if in bizarre, you know, form that is easier to sort of set back, and even to himself he can say, see, I am still a monster after all. I love that. It's a great instinct by the actor. It really came up with something kind of cool. This is a nice little beat too. It's clear if he makes it through the battle, he's definitely gonna kill him, you know. Now this whole little this story here at the end of the Jacobites hearing that the Duke of Cumberland is having a birthday party, and that perhaps this gives them an opportunity to go stage a surprise attack on them, you know, the night before Culloden, is actually true. This really did happen historically. They did get word that not from Jack Randall, obviously, but they did get word that it was the Duke's birthday and they were having a party, and that they thought that this was a great opportunity for a sneak attack. They really did march through the night. They really did get lost. You know, the columns were separated. It was the plan was probably a little too complicated for them to accomplish. And when the two forces did not join up as planned, they then called off the attack. And it was kind of one of the great what ifs of the Jacobite Rebellion, is what if this had they've been able to pull this off? What if they had attacked, you know, and surprised the Duke's forces, you know, while they were otherwise distracted? Would history have turned out differently? It's a fascinating question. You know, it just goes to again emphasize how difficult warfare was in this year. There was a reason why they didn't do a lot of night attacks. You know, when the sun went down, the armies tended not to fight with one another because it was hard to communicate. It was hard to sort of find your way. You know, forget about GPS and navigation. You know, they didn't have very good maps. And even they had maps, they were, you know, they had ridden by lanterns, which would give away your position, and it was really hard to navigate in the dark. And it was almost impossible to communicate. You know, in the days before radio, it was really hard, almost impossible, to control larger bodies of men at night in the darkness. Well, there you have it. That was episode 212. I think it's a really solid piece of work. Very proud of that episode. And that now takes us to the exciting 90-minute finale of Outlander Season 2 in episode 213, which we will be talking about next week. Thank you for joining me. Until then, good night and good luck.